Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Born to Talk radio show. Do I tell you every week how much I love doing this? Because it's the truth. My guest today is Deanna Ziegler. She's the founder and CEO of Z Creators. It's a digital media production and consulting service, and she's the author of a fabulous book called Midnight Train from Georgia. Welcome to the show, Deanna.
Thank you so much, Masha. It's my pleasure to be here.
Oh, I love doing this because people are so interesting and you are no exception. Why don't you start off by just telling our audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, as you said, I'm the founder and president of Z Creators, a multimedia production digital and consulting company. I built my career, however, in education. So I'm also a retired professor. So I'm Professor Emerita at Florida A&M University, where I've built my career really in journalism and radio and television, which brought me to writing not only books, but music and poetry and things like that. I was born and raised in New York City, one block from the Apollo Theater was where I was born on 124th Street. If people know the Apollo, it's on 125th Street. So I sort of, grew up in the music and entertainment world. And in, of course, growing up in New York City, you're just surrounded by the arts. So I've always been influenced by writing and music, et cetera. So that's just a small little snapshot because I've done a whole lot of things in my life and my career. But, you know, that could get us started.
Well, do you sing? I'm just curious. Do you also sing?
I had two bands, actually.
Really?
A Time and Space. We never recorded, but I was a songwriter and producer, and I wrote a number one disco song, Time Moves On, by group Strut in 1975.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm, you know, basically, and I still write music. I still love music.
Do you?
Yes.
I do. Don't you? I mean, you say that, and I'm telling you, honestly, my right hand went right over my heart. I love music too. I really do love music. If there's something about music, and certainly in the old days when I was growing up as a teenager, you know, I just, you know, from the Beatles to the Rolling Stones to, you know, you name it, I loved it. Right. And I love music, but I love the genre of music that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, and music connects, you know, continents. I mean, I've gone around the world, and even though we can't understand each other or speak, we understand rhythm and music, and we can dance and have a good time together.
You bet.
It's that universal language.
It really is. So I'm really curious about this. So what inspired you to write your book, Midnight Train from Georgia? Listen to what I'm saying, people. Not Midnight Train to Georgia. Midnight Train from Georgia.
Yes, but I'll say Midnight Train from Georgia has a lot to do with Midnight Train to Georgia.
I suspect that it did.
Yes.
I'm already humming it in my head. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, Midnight Train from Georgia is the inspirational story of the renowned singing group Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Right.
And the reason why I played on the title and called it Midnight Train from Georgia is because they really, even though they were born and raised in Georgia, they actually left Georgia to become the successful group that we know as Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Wow, that's so cool.
You know, because they started as little children. And
really?
They started as little children, and they were also related. The first members of the Pips was Gladys Knight, her brother Merrill Bubba Knight, her sister Brenda Knight, William Franklin Guest, and his sister Eleanor Guest. So this book is written from the eyes and the experience of one of the Pips, William Franklin Guest.
Okay, so who was William Franklin Guest, and how did that Gladys Knight and the Pips get started? Who was he?
Let me go first for full disclosure.
Yes, ma'am.
William Franklin Guest is actually my brother-in-law.
Oh.
So I lived this story since I was 11 years old.
Wow.
So that is also part of the inspiration for writing this book. And William and I, and you're hearing me go from William to Babe Ruth, because everybody called him Babe Ruth. He grew up in a musical family. I mean, he would say that he learned music while he was in his mother's belly, because his mother, father, uncle, and grandmother, they used to have jam sessions on their back porch in
wow.
Georgia. And it's so interesting because the neighborhood would come just to hear them play their music and sing. And it started with the family singing and dancing on the back porch. His grandmother, we call Mama Tilly, she actually taught he and his sister how to sing harmony. But he learned especially how to sing harmony in the kitchen with her while she was cooking. So as a little boy, they grew up in music. He and his sister, Eleanor Guest, who was also one of the original Pips, they were cousins to the Knight family. You know, so ironically, how the actual group got started was a fluke, because actually Bubba was having his 10th birthday party. And they were all together having this party, and a friend of theirs, Garfield, they invited, because Garfield had a little record player, used to be able to carry around these little record players. So he came over with his record player and, you know, playing the 45s or the 78s.
Yep.
And I know our audience, if they have to be old enough to know what a 78 record
or a 45, because the 45
had a thick and one was very small.
So, and the 45s had a bigger hole in the center,
and
right?
A bigger hole, because you had to have that little centerpiece that you
exactly.
In
oh
the
my
middle
God.
Of your record player.
Yes.
So they were having just a great time at the birthday party, but Garfield had to go home. So after Garfield left, they were like, oh, well, what do we do? So they just decided to start singing together. And the parents were also there. So they were singing contemporary songs, and their parents, Mama Margaret, that's William's mother, and Mama Knight, we call everybody Mama Margaret, Mama Knight, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
They heard them and said, wow, these kids sound good together. So just from that harmony, and for Garfield taking his record player home, that's when the family says, well, we need to maybe start having them sing together. So that's how they started singing. So the Gladys Knight and the Pips that most of the audience know, or all of the audience for the most part, that wasn't the original group. The original group, they were called the Pips, and that was after a cousin's name. They had a cousin named Pip. Again, it was all family.
Right.
And he basically was helping them, you know, go to perform at little parties and stuff like that. And they just used to call them the kids. The kids are going to be performing tonight. And
that's
then they decided, you know, we have to have a name. So they decided that they would name the group after Cousin Pip.
That's cool.
Which is where the name came from.
Excellent. Well, let me ask you, what impact did the church and the gospel music have on the career of that group?
Well, I'm going to tell you, that is the foundation of the group. And to think about it, their parents, Ma Margaret, William's mother, Gladys' mother and their father, they sang in the adult choir at Mount Moriah Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. And the kids became part of the kids' choir. So they were brought up clapping and singing. And then, of course, Mama Tilly, the grandmother, she was at the church too. So they were singing all the time. Mom Margaret was the secretary of the church. So they would tell you that they spent most of their early young life in church, not just singing on Sunday, you know, but during the week with all kinds of different activities going on. And that's how they really, I won't say that that's where they got the soul from, because a lot of that is internal as far as spirit. But that definitely has the foundation of the gospel music, which has a lot to do with a lot of the Black or African-American groups during that time coming up. A lot of them came through the gospel church or through the blues.
Uh-huh, true. So yeah. I'm just thinking about, you know, you're talking about when I was really getting into music based on these decades. So what was the music scene like in the 50s and the 60s? I know what it was like for me. What was it like for you guys?
Well, I'm telling you, I always say being raised in New York City, growing up in New York City, sort of warps your reality. Because, you know, in New York, you have so many different cultures. Uh-huh. And I said that I learned socialization right in the subway. Because, you know, you're right up in everybody's faces. So it wasn't unusual for me to see people from all over the world and to be right next to them. But nice. That's another thing, listening to my brother-in-law's stories, and this book came about as a result of me videotaping him for several years to get the story. But I found out that growing up in the South was a lot different from growing up in New York City. I mean, the music scene, if you think about the 1950s, for example, you had Ray Charles, Jackie Wilson, you know, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry. I saw these people on television. So I'm not thinking that there are any kind of issues going on, just even getting from one performance to another, you know. But in the 50s, it was a lot different. I mean, especially for African-Americans, they could not stay in certain hotels. You know, they couldn't go to certain restaurants. So they had to find various places to stay. Yet and still, they performed in these great large venues.
Isn't that something? Isn't that, you know,
right?
That's so, you know what flash through my mind right now was mm-hmm. American Bandstand. I don't know why.
Right, but you know, thanks to American Bandstand, not only American Bandstand, but the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely.
That changed it. And if anybody, Ed Sullivan, they have a documentary on Ed Sullivan. Now, I think it's on Netflix or whatever. But he talked about the music of that time because he was told not to have certain guests.
Oh, brother.
On the program. Gladys Knight and the Pips was one of the first groups that he had on the Ed Sullivan Show.
No kidding. There's people listening to this going, who's Ed Sullivan? But, you know, you have to be of a certain generation to know who Ed Sullivan was,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but Ed Sullivan, I mean, if in our generation, that's where you were on Sunday. You were yep. in front of your TV yes. watching all the groups, the big groups, white groups, black groups, or whatever, all of the groups, they were coming through the Ed Sullivan Show. When he was
sure.
showcasing, you know, the best performances, it was it. That it was almost like being live at the Apollo Theater, you know, or any of the big venues. So he was the person, the same thing with, you know, American Bandstand.
Yeah.
All of that stuff, you know, was going on and, you know, trying to integrate the music, but it was separate. But when you saw it on TV, You know, it was just people having fun, singing and dancing.
Right. You were just part of it. Absolutely.
Yeah, you were part of it. That's why I said it kind of warped my reality about actually what was going on to grow up in New York City. I mean, I saw, you know, the civil rights movement and all that stuff on television, you know, so it was just a lot different. And I realized later on, not as so much as a kid, but I realized what a different experience I had than my brother-in-law, William, and his sister and Bubba and Gladys and all of them growing up.
Right.
You know, it was a whole different world. But you know, by the time the 1960s came, you know, I mean, that's when a lot of the intermingling had started. We started seeing the diversity and stuff on the programs and on television. You started getting, you know, more entertainers and more reviews. By that time, you know, Diana Ross and Supremes, you know, all of the various groups like that, they were all a part of Ed Sullivan and American Bandstand, and also the other program that we had, Soul Train.
Oh, yeah, Soul, know? Oh my gosh, I forgot about Soul Train.
All of these things started coming together, you know, after a while, but in the...
Yes.
Early in the beginning, you know, it was just these one or two people. And I remember even growing up, it would be so exciting when a Black entertainer was going to be on Ed Sullivan. You know, I mean, the word got around, everybody was in front of their TV. So it was a different scene than it is now. I mean, young people, they have no idea
what it was like then.
What it was like. And even, you know, various different radio stations and what music could be played, where, et cetera. But I'm glad that it evolved.
I am too. Well, you know, I think I understood from you that William almost died in a car accident performing on the road. How did that impact his early career?
But, you know, and that's when they were young. And as I said, that, you know, when they were going around the South and they would, you know, be in these raggedy cars, they talk about their little car that they had so sometime push up and down, you know, the hill and stuff. But he happened to have been falling. He fell asleep and a car hit right. He was in the back, right on his side, but it affected his legs. Both legs were damaged pretty bad. And, you know, at that time, again, they were on and, you know, they were just on tour and they just left him in the hospital and they had to keep, you know, going and making that change, that money.
Wow.
But, excuse me, he basically, you know, thought his career was over, his legs and all of that, but they weren't the precision dancers as they became at that time, but they were making up routines and dancing was a part of their career. But one member of the group, Langston, who again, he was not, he came as part of the group. He was an outsider a little bit later because he wasn't a cousin, it wasn't a relative, but he resuscitated him, and that's the reason why he's alive,
Thank God.
But he worried about that, but he was determined.
Sure,
you know, so
I guess so.
He got himself together, and, you know, after a couple of months or so, was able to go back and join the group. But
great.
He thought that... you know, that's
tough.
The time it is. And to the point, I mean, he was always paranoid. He told us, even as little kids, remember, I lived this story since I was 11 years old. And he told us, don't go to sleep in a car. Make sure you pay attention. I mean, he was really, really paranoid about that throughout his whole life.
Understandable. So let me ask you this. What influence did Bobby Robinson of Fury Records and Marguerite Mays have on the career for Gladys Knight and the Pips? And you might want to tell people who Marguerite Mays is as well.
Okay, well, let me go ahead and start first with Bobby Robinson.
Sure, please.
Because this is, during the time, even as they were kids and they're in Atlanta, they were asked to come over. They thought they were just coming over to test some recording equipment. Someone says, oh, come over and test. We want to see exactly what you all sound like on tape. So they went over thinking that they were just testing out some equipment. Well, the person, because there was a lot of ripping off during those days, the yes. person actually took their recording and pressed a record.
Oh, no.
Every Beat of My Heart. Every Beat of My Heart, the record started gaining traction, right? And became sort of a hit all of a sudden. Well, how my brother-in-law, how they found out that the record was out. And if you remember the old days, they used to have record shops and the music, remember the music used to be blasting on the street
yep.
from the record shop? Well, my brother-in-law was walking past the record shop and heard their record on the radio.
Oh my gosh.
That's the first time. So he calls Bubba and says, Bubba, they're playing our record. And Bubba says, yes, I know. I just found out. It's on the radio. Well, that's how they found out. Of course, they didn't get any royalties or anything as a result, but the record was playing on the radio around the country. Bobby Robinson was head of Fury Records in New York. He heard that record and wanted to find them. So he got in touch with this DJ in Georgia and said, look, I need you to find this group. And his last name was Patton, and he found out where they were and got them in touch with Bobby Robinson. Bobby Robinson, okay, another slickster kind of, but he really helped kick off their career, called their parents, flew the parents and the group to New York City, told the group that he was interested in recording and managing them because they have this hit record and he just loved their music. But there was one little dilemma. The record that had been put out illegally, that record was called Every Beat of My Heart by the Pips. So Bobby said, I want to re-record this. He said, but what we have to do is we have to change the name and let's call it Gladys Knight and the Pips. That's how it became Gladys Knight and the Pips, because they were just the Pips. But to distinguish between those two recordings that he was going to promote, he said that we'll put that out. And then the rest is history. Both of them became number one hits. And ironically, a few weeks ago, I heard Every Beat of My Heart on the radio, and they just said, by the Pips. So that must have been the first recording. They didn't say Gladys Knight and the Pips. So both recordings are still out there in history.
Interesting. That's so, really interesting.
Yeah, so Bobby Robinson was the one who got them to New York, where they first performed at the Apollo Theater. Also, I don't know, maybe people may not know about this, but Hotel Teresa was very famous in Harlem. Even Castro stayed there. I mean, and that's, it's a landmark. So they were just glad, wow, they're in a high-rise hotel, you know, they're on stage and all this. But they weren't making a whole lot of money, you know why? Because Bobby Robinson, remember those suits? Those clothes, those hotels, they were ripping off the music scene back in the 50s and 60s. They were ripping off these artists. The artists today, they're making a whole lot more money. Well, as a result, after a while, Gladys actually just wanted to get married. So Gladys decided to leave the group. And go back to Atlanta. So that just left the Pips. Now, my brother-in-law was a songwriter, you know, and until he died, he was a songwriter. So he wrote some songs that Bobby Robinson recorded just as the Pips with the guys. Linda and Darling were two of the songs. You know, they didn't go, you know, gold like some of the other records, but, you know, they got a lot of airplay, especially in New York.
Uh-huh.
Well, things started getting, you know, a little bit rough for them. In fact, they had to go back to Atlanta because Bobby Robinson was taking all the money. But then the guys decided, well, we're going to go back to New York. And they did. At that time, when they came back to New York, because they, you know, they knew that they had to get away from Bobby Robinson as their manager, my brother-in-law met Margarita Mays, who was the niece of Marguerite Mays. Marguerite Mays was the former wife of the great baseball player, Willie Mays?
Oh my gosh.
She was his wife. She was also married to one of the coasters before that. So she was in the business. So she knew about their music and asked Margarita if she would bring the guys over to meet her. And she did. She brought them over. So Marguerite says, look, I've heard your music, and I think that you guys are okay, but I think that you all could do much more and be a lot better if you can get Gladys to come back.
Oh, yeah.
So they called Gladys. Marguerite Mays called Gladys. And, you know, talked to her, and Gladys decided to come back. And Marguerite Mays took them all, kept them over there on the island. And I remember my brother-in-law talks about that she had 3 or 4 cars, and she would give them a car. Okay, you take this car, because I want you to go out, I don't want y'all to have to ask anybody for anything. You got your own car, you're going to have money in your pocket, you're going to have the right clothes. So
nice.
Marguerite Mays, there's a chapter in the book that I call Polishing Up Their Act. She polished up their act.
Nice.
She also went and found Charlie Atkins. Charlie Atkins was part of the duo Honey Cole and Charlie Atkins tap dancers. They were big tap dancers in the 40s, and Honey Cole ended up owning the Apollo later on. But they were tap dancers. So Marguerite Mays found Charlie Atkins and says, I want you to teach them some routines. Now, and I remember my brother-in-law telling this story, and he would get a can, like a soda can, and a pencil and tap, so that Charlie Atkins used to just tap these cans with some beats.
Like a drum,
and they had to do dance steps to those precise rhythms that he tapped on that can.
Wow.
So that, those dance steps and what they are really known for and their precision and stuff, and many people always thought that William was the best dancer. Charlie Atkins said that he always learned the steps precisely as he taught them. So that's what really polished up the group, that, you know, Marguerite Mays put Gladys in gowns, put them in the suits and all of that, and took them, I guess, as far as she could take them, you know, at that particular time. But it had a great impact on their career, for
sure.
I bet.
Well, I'm curious. So how did William meet your sister Patricia, who later became his wife?
Well, I have to go back just a couple of years or so before that, because it's back in the Bobby Robinson days. My mother knew Bobby Robinson. So my mother, they were having a recording session, and my mother took my brother and my sister. I guess I was too young. And that's how they met. And they met during that time. They didn't see each other 2 years later during the Marguerite Mays. And William, he'll always say, even when I came, I went back to Georgia, but I couldn't get that girl, Pat, off of my mind. That Patricia was still on my mind.
Oh, that's great. Love.
Yeah. So when they came back to New York under Marguerite Mays, And I guess my sister maybe was about 17 or 18, because they married when she was 19. Then they started dating then, because he was on the road traveling, you know, at that particular time. Because, again, they met when she was 15, I was 11, but then like 17, then they got, you know, back together. And when she was 19, they married. But it was because of my mother taking my sister to a recording session. And, you know, our love for music had a lot to do with my mother, too. She had us at the Apollo all the time as kids, especially Wednesday night amateur hour, which was fun. My sister and I even won the twist contest at the Apollo.
Oh, my gosh.
She won for the older girls and I won for the younger. I'll never forget, because it was $25 and she won $100. I mean,
wow.
During that time, that was a lot of money
you
for kids.
Bet.
You know, so that was exciting. But that's because of that, my mother crossover love for music and stuff and taking her, that's how they met.
Okay, so you just threw another memory. That's Domino? Was that the twist?
Come on, baby.
I think that was Fats Domino, right?
Yeah. I'm going to look that up. I don't want to be wrong.
Okay, well, I you know what? I'm pulling this out of a memory disk in my brain that's
you may be right, but
I can just hear Let's Twist Again like we did last summer.
Yeah, like we did last year.
Like we did last year. Oh my gosh. I love music. I know that people would say, give me a book, because I could just sit down for...
Oh, you know who I think it was?
Who?
I said, it came up, Hank Bass.
Chuck Berry?
Do you know who Chubby Checker made
it famous? Oh, Chubby Checker. You're right.
Chubby Checker made it famous, but
yes.
Hank Ballett wrote it.
Got it, but it was Chubby Checker. You're right.
Chubby Checker.
For those of you that are listening to this.
All the way down to the ground.
Oh, my gosh. You know, one of the things I love so much about podcasting, and you know this, is I keep it real. And sometimes I don't have my information correct, but you are bringing up so many memories. Because for me, while some people loved reading books and all that stuff, not me. I was into music. I loved music. I still love music.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously I don't live in New York, so I've never been to the Apollo, but I think just music is something that binds us as people.
Yes.
That's what
does.
I think. I think it's a connector.
That's a universal language that brings us together.
You don't even have to speak the language, but you learn how to sing it.
Right, that's right, that's right.
That's true. So let me ask you, what was it like for the group to be part of the Motown scene with so many stars at that time? That must have been unbelievable.
Yeah, it was, you know, because one year after they got married, the group signed with Motown. And it's so funny because people don't know, Gladys really did not want to go to Motown.
Oh.
She thought that, you know, because, you know, they had Diana Ross, the Supreme, the Marvelettes, Martha and the Vandellas, that she would get lost with all of the famous female groups that they had. But the way they worked as a group, they prayed before each performance, and they would take a vote on everything. And she got outvoted by the guys. So that's how they ended up with Motown. I mean, Motown, and I tell you, as a kid, you know, by that time, I'm like 16, 17, and they're in Detroit, and that Motown music is blasting all over the place, and the various groups on the scene. And when they signed with Motown, a caveat what people don't know about either is Berry Gordy wanted Charlie Atkins too, because remember they had all these male groups.
Right.
So, and they saw what Charlie Atkins had done to Gladys Knight and the Pips, their performance. And so he got a contract along with them, but he said he would only go with them if he can continue to always work with Glasnow and the Pips.
That's cool.
So you think about Motown had a particular culture. The females went to charm school.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yeah. They had a whole inner culture among that culture. The ladies had to go to charm school. The guys, they were in dancing school. You know, I mean, it was all of that. How you greet and talk to the audiences. And you think about that in the 1960s, all those groups were a class act.
Yes.
You know, on television, you saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show, you saw them on interviews and stuff. All of that was a part of the training and the culture that was brought about as opposed to, you know, as a result of the Motown philosophy and Barry Gordy's vision of what the music industry could be.
Sure.
So that was a very big and exciting time, and everything was rocking. I heard it through the grapevine, and that was their, you know, first number one song on Motown. It had already been recorded by Marvin Gaye, but they made it go number one.
So,
yeah, so they were out there, and there was a lot of the Motown reviews where they would go with all the groups. But they had their own booking agency, so they didn't always do the Motown reviews. Sometimes they just did things on their own.
I see.
You know, which also brought them, you know, into the next level of their career.
So why did Gladys Knight and the Pips ultimately leave Motown Records?
You know, I told you they were ripping off people everywhere, and that includes Barry Gordy. You know, getting the royalties and stuff, and they continued with Barry until it was time to renew the contract, and they wanted, by that time they had reached a certain prominence, and they really wanted a certain amount of money, and Barry would not, he was holding off giving them the contract that they wanted. But here comes great Buddha Records. Buddha Records gave them everything they wanted. They gave them the contract they wanted. They gave them the 100 full-time attention. And that's when Midnight Train to Georgia was recorded.
Interesting.
Yeah, the Imagination album. That's, at that point, that turned the corner for them. That's when they started winning all the American Music Awards, the Grammy Awards, etc. And another thing that was so important about them, they did not stay at all a rhythm and blues group.
Oh.
They crossed over to pop.
Interesting. That's,
yeah, they did a lot of pop music, so they were able to relate to Black audiences, white audiences, international audiences. They became global. Because their music was, you couldn't put it, just call it soul music. By that time, they were really into pop. That management took them and made them the super, super stars that we know.
What was give me an example of a pop song that I can't think of.
The Jackson 5 did pop songs.
Right.
You know, let's see.
That's okay. I put you on the spot. Maybe it'll come to you.
No, you're talking about a Gladys Knight and the Pips song? That's a pop song?
Yeah, what was a pop song?
I mean, you got to use my imagination. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do remember
that. Love Overboard?
Oh,
that's
yes, okay.
Song. That would be it a pop is. Song. I mean, it's not a song. It's not saying I lost my love to you down there, and then everything went overboard and I drowned.
No.
It was so pop music is, you know, just music that it can appeal to various audiences.
Yes. And generations, you know,
right,
I'm sure.
Yes, yes.
So how would you describe the accomplishments of Gladys Knight and the Pips and the impact that they had on their music?
I mean, if you think about it, and as we're talking, and you know these songs, their music has lasted for decades.
Yes.
I mean, even now, they became global superstars. And, you know, I think that I always say that what made them so successful, too, is that their whole career was about family, love, spirituality, and harmony that goes more than the blending of voices, but the blending of spirit. Uh-huh. So they were what I would call sort of an apple pie group, like a bubblegum, you know, almost like the early Jackson Five, you know. Oh, yeah. And I mean, just a group that, you know, they dress classy, they performed. You never had any kind of scandals, you know, about them. They were just out there bringing you the music, the performances, and the dancing, and giving it everything that they had. And because, right, as we were talking about the universal music, their messages and their beat and their performances went around this world that people just embraced.
Absolutely. I would agree with you completely. So, unfortunately, Gladys Knight and the Pips broke up in 1989 after almost four decades. What impact do you think they had on the group, especially on Williams' life?
Well, and I'll just talk about a little bit what was leading up to that. Okay. You know, they became really, they got to the pinnacle of success at one point, even before they broke up. And I don't know if many people know that Gladys Knight and the Pips, they were signed to three different labels.
Oh.
Gladys was signed to Columbia Records by herself. Gladys Knight and the Pips were signed to Buddha Records. And the Pips were signed to Casablanca.
Oh, interesting.
So they got to a point where they wanted to branch out and do different things. You know, they were doing movie tracks, you know, various different kinds of activity. excuse me, my brother-in-law, William, and Edward Patton, the other Pip, they had a company, Patton Guest Production. I was also around in those days in one of these, sure, adventures that they had. I created, designed and created disco bells. Disco bells were bells you wore on your wrists and your ankles. They were in Cosmopolitan, oh, and Essence. Yeah. They were, uh-huh, in when John Travolta first walks in to Saturday Night Fever and he does this thing with his wrist. He's wearing disco bells. Well, right, I created these things. They gave me the money. I mean, well, I wrote a bank. I was like 19 years old or something and wrote a $100,000 bank proposal and got $50,000 of it.
Hey,
but I had the backing of their name at age, wow, 19. But, you know, they were branching off. By this time, they were so successful in the music. They were branching. They wanted to do other things.
Sure. Sure. And, that's understandable.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm, and them doing other things, and Gladys wanted to do some more film stuff. And it got a little muddy, you know. So, as a result, and the Pips by themselves weren't successful with their label. Gladys wasn't as successful with her label by herself, but Gladys Knight and the Pips music and stuff was still successful. So after, but then it got to the point, but again, remember they're all family, so there wasn't like a big argument and breakup. They just decided, well, you know, it's time, maybe we're going to go out and branch out and do, sure, our own thing. And, yeah, that's what they did. But I don't think, well, I don't say I don't think. I know for sure. William never got over it. You know, remember he was listening to music since he was in his mama's belly.
Right.
So that was his whole life.
Right.
And that group, even though they've been together four decades. But, you know, here you are now when you're 60s or so, and you've done this all your life since, you know, you're young, but of course, like he was maybe like the 50s or so then, but still, what do? Well, he started a company with a couple of his friends called Crew Records, and they started trying to do some other things on their own. But he never got over the breakup because, you know, again, that's what he had done all of his life.
Sure.
And he really, I think, because he even tried to, at one time he wanted to record with just Bubba, because after a while, after they gotten inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I'll talk about that in a minute, Edward died. He was alive for that, but one of them died, so there were only two. And if you, I don't know if you remember Sam and Dave, the group, Hold On, I'm Coming, et cetera. Well,
I remember that song.
Yeah, William's idea was that he and Bubba could become like a Sam and Dave.
I see.
So he was still writing music and stuff like that. I mean, it didn't come to pass, but he was still really kind of focused in on that, you know, until he died, he was still focusing on his music.
Interesting. Well, you had mentioned the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They were inducted in 1996. And why do you think they were inducted so early when other groups who came up along when they were there, such as Dionne Warwick, they were just recently inducted? What do you think allowed them to be inducted so early like that?
Yeah, and even some of, I was just looking at the class, I can't remember all the names even this year, but a lot of these people came up with them, you know. But I think, again, I think that because they crossed over from rhythm and blues to pop, and they had such a global appeal, and their music was so impactful that, I mean, it went across cultures. I could go in any country and they know that music, you know, and they became just a global group who, again, as I said, they were a class act. There was never any kind of dirt or scandal. And the fact that their music crossing over to that pop music, that's like classical going to jazz. So you got two big different audiences,
right?
You know, just consuming that same music. And I don't think it's fair when I looked at Dionne Warwick 2 or 3 years ago, because Gladys and all of them, Patti LaBelle, they were all friends growing up.
Uh-huh.
And they were all great musicians. And why did it take so long? I don't know for the others, but I think for them, it was because they had such a global appeal and their music was so impactful around the world.
Yeah, that's interesting. So was Bubba older or younger?
Than Gladys?
Uh-huh.
He's younger than Gladys and younger than my brother-in-law, too, just by a couple of years. So he always, you know, he was more like a big brother to Bubba.
Who was a big brother to Bubba?
William was. Because he always, yeah. You know, again, they were all cousins and stuff, so...
True.
Right.
So although William loved and was married to your sister, he fathered other kids and had outside relationships with other women, which is probably nothing that you're really happy about. How did that impact his life and his marriage?
Well, and this is going to be, it may sound strange to the audience, but they have to know that when, even back there in the 50s, when we all met, we became one family, the Knight family, the Guest family, and the Ziegler family. So we were very, 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 very close. William, when Pat and William got married, he already had one daughter before they got married. So she knew about that. But the world of entertainment, even now, is crazy like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, men chase women, women chase men, et cetera. Doesn't mean that you have to go and get involved, but that was the nature of the scene even now. But back then, you know, they would call it what they call, they were slinging it everywhere, all different kinds of it. And, you know, he was a very, very attractive man, et cetera. And attracted women, so he got involved and fathered some outside kids. My sister eventually divorced him, but what's going to sound strange is that they stayed together. He lived upstairs, but she took care of him to the end of his life. I mean, not in that in between during the divorce thing. Well, he got sick. He came back home to that family, and that family kept him and took care of him until he actually died. But what, again, we were all one family, and my sister, because in the book I interview my sister and the kids and stuff, because I would just say, well, they just loved each other forever, which I will still say that. She would say that he became more like her brother than a husband. And if you would go out, even when they were divorced, they would still be holding hands, laughing, having fun, because that's the way we grew up. You know, there was not, I'm sure that they had their little stuff, you know, when they were by themselves, but there was a lot of joy. And to know his spirit, he brought just a whole lot of joy, you know, and probably that has something to do with those babies too. But
okay.
You know, but the one thing.
Are they all musical too? Does the music just go down from generation to generation to generation?
What do you mean, go down from generation to
generation? Well, I mean, I'm just saying these children.
Other people in the sing? My niece sings, but his grandchild, his granddaughter, Terry Mirage, she is, well, she's called Terry Shu, S-H-U, because that's her mother's married name. She's the singer.
Okay.
My niece can sing, but her daughter is a singer and entertainer, and she does a lot of singing and stuff around Detroit. So, yeah, there is some, it did pass down.
That's nice.
Yeah,
I'm
and
not
my
surprised.
My niece sings too, but Terry is really, we call her TJ, because the father's name was Terry, and he never had a son, so she ended up being Terry Jr. TJ.
That's
so
funny.
But and she, I mean, she could sing anything from jazz, but she's a rock singer. She loves rock, but she's good. She's a good performer.
That's wonderful. So, during the latter part of his life, William produced other groups and continued to record music. Was he successful on his own?
Well, you know, just before he died, he was recording an album, believe it or not. He produced in Detroit the Stub Girls, the Stub Girls. Who were the Stub Girls?
I don't know.
Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops, the lead singer of the Four Tops. It was his nieces. In fact, Levi Stubbs, Deborah Stubbs, his daughter is one of my sister's best friends. She's also, they're all in the same church. Well, all of that, again, the Motown children, it's so funny. When I go to Detroit and I go out with my niece and nephew, because I hang out with them, we go to different places and they'll say, they know all the Motown kids. Oh, this was so-and-so king. These Motown kids still hang out. One of the things that Motown did is, you know, as I said, they had the culture. They used to have picnics where they would bring all the families together. So all these kids grew up together, you know, so they all know each other. And the Stub Girls were just kind of singing around Detroit. So my brother-in-law, they recorded them. They didn't become major stars, but they got some performances around. And because their name was Stubbs in the first place, they got a lot of performances around. Mm-hmm. He recorded a few songs, but he never completed his album, you know. And I think about that sometime, and maybe one day we can put some of those songs out.
Sure. It's interesting how you've been intertwining Detroit, because my husband was from Detroit. And so I know that music was very, very, very special.
The Motor City,
honey.
Yes.
So what lessons were learned do you think that William would want to leave behind to share with the young artists about the things he learned about the entertainment industry?
Right. I mean, and throughout, and even before I started videotaping him, you know, about the last 7 years or so of his life, But he always, and one of the things was all of these outside kids. You know, he wanted people to learn from his life. Number one, to learn the business. You know, he wanted to leave behind an understanding that this business can bring you up or it can bring you totally down. So, you know, he left some lessons learned in as it relates to the music. And again, as I said, the artists of today, they're a lot smarter. You know, they, a lot of them manage themselves. You know, they don't have all of these in-between people that could take all of their royalties. The other thing is your relationships. Like, he was never, although he always, and I could say this without any reservation, he always took care of my sister, and he also took care of his kids, all of them. You know, even to this day, his kids, not necessarily my sisters, but the royalties and stuff goes to his kids. So he owned his mistakes, you know, but he never thought that any of his kids were mistakes because he loved them all. That's, you know, and we would all be together. You know, we would all be together. There was no kind of, you know, love and jealousy and hate. That's how we were brought up, with just love. And that was, you know, really, I never got in between he and my sister. I mean, he called me little Dada because my brother basically died 3 weeks before, 3 weeks after they got married. So he became the brother and the son. So I was his little sister. He was my big brother. So, but I never got in between them two because I loved them both. But, you know, he always wanted to make sure that she was taken care of. He apologized even on his deathbed. I was at the hospital where he was still apologizing. I'm sorry. I love you. I'm sorry. You know, so all of this, you know, all of the outside, like you said, even though all that temptations and stuff is out there, after your performance, you go home, you know. So all of just the things that I learned about the business and how to take care of your business, you know, and how to be a man. And I would say that he really, even I look at my nephews, one of the things he instilled in them, be a man, be a good man, you know, and various things that he just sort of instilled in all of us, not to make the mistakes that he made. And he made sure that we, even as a family, that, you know, we had to be classy. He would always tell me, even when he was on the road, you know, I don't want y'all backstage. I don't want to hear about anything with entertainment. So we, you know, just like their group, the Apple Pie group, that's how we tried to keep our everything clean and, you know, just draped in love and trying to do the best and treating people right. Everybody loved him because he was not only entertaining and funny, he really treated people right.
That's nice. How long did it take you to write that book?
Well, probably, I mean, I videotaped him for like 7 years. Wow. So, and I had listened to these stories since I was like 11 years old. And again, just observing, the hardest part for me is I had the story in so many different ways from so many hours. You know, I had about maybe 15, 20 hours of videos, and it was hard trying to get the best parts of the story, sure, transcribing at that, coupled with I do commentary too in the book based on my observations. So it's his life, and then I do commentary based on, you know, my experience and the fact that I lived the story too.
Well, I can tell you, people that have listened to this podcast are going to want to go out and buy your book because it is available, correct?
Yes, it is available. It's easy to get on Amazon or Barnes and Noble or wherever you get your books. And if they don't have it, tell them to get it.
That's right. There you go. Well, I just want to thank you. You are an amazing woman, and people that are listening to this can feel that about you. I can feel it about you.
Well, we have such a wonderful rapport that has been wonderful.
Well, you know,
having this conversation.
Absolutely. It's really been wonderful because you brought up memories for me that, especially when it comes to music, you know, I'm going to be humming A Midnight Train from Georgia for the rest of the day. So I just want to thank you so very much for taking the time to share your story with our audience. This has really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And thank you for being such a wonderful host and even inviting me on. I have enjoyed it immensely.
Well, terrific. So I will let you get on with the rest of your day. And I know that people are going to love this podcast. So thank you once again for joining me. You take good care of yourself, okay?
You too. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.